Hey y'all, very special episode of All Your Things Gone this week. Jeff Mueller stopped by months ago, and I thought it was appropriate to talk to him because, well, mainly, he's a hero of mine, and majority of my guitar technique is based on his. But in addition, his many bands had an influence on this area in one way or another. Made friends, musicians, bands, and such. So it was great to talk to him. Just a very nice, sweet, genuine person. And thank him for coming by. And thank you for listening. This is All Your Things Are Gone. How are you, sir?
Oh my gosh. Well, truth be told, I just got done scrubbing a bunch of dishes, cleaning a day's worth of life out of my house, and hanging out with my kiddos and work and everything. I'm pretty good, though. I'm excited to talk to you. Thank you so much for thank you for considering me and thinking of me in this giant family of beautiful people that you've already spoken with as they relate to the Boston music scene. I really, really appreciate that consideration. Thank you.
I thought that you were relevant. Obviously, I'm a fan, but I wanted to talk to you because I think that you have some influence and you were spent some time here with some of the people around here and had an influence on those people. So,
man, that's really, really, really nice of you to say. And you know, I was considering the whole conversation over the course of the past week since you asked me, and I realized initially I wasn't 100% clear-headed or certain I wasn't certain how immersed in Boston so much of my music history sort of actually is, because in many ways, like the first Rodin show outside of Louisville was in Boston. It was at the Middle East, So that's something, and that's where, I don't know. It's such a curious duration and like time frame spanning, you know, over almost 30 years now from my first trip to Boston and meeting. Some seriously influential people, as far as I'm concerned, like Billy Ruane and at the time our agency, Suzanne McCarthy, and Flower Booking was in Boston as well. But,
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
And our the first Rodin trip was in fact with Talia and Chris and Arthur and Seth, and when Come asked us to travel with them, and they were Boston.
Yep.
You know, and the first Juno 44 show ever was at TT the Bears in November of 94. So it's just kind of crazy how much of that stuff sort of rose to the surface when I just actually kind of dug in and thought about it. So
was there something that brought you to Boston in some respects, or was it just natural? Did it just happen?
I think it just sort of happened. I mean, in our sort of like early 20s, from our early 20s perspective, and wanting for Rodin, you know, starting there, I think, being that Boston was as far northeast as we were going to probably go on our first trip, and it seemed like a proper vantage point. And then similarly with Juno 44, I think that was the case as well. But we just fell in love with so many people from that neck of the woods, you know, and just so many friends and such a supportive at that time. Just to be clear, I'm not 100% sure on what the music community is like there now. Because I've been in and out of phase with traveling with music for the past, like, I don't know, like 5 or 10 years. It's been off and on, but back then, you know, there was just so much music happening in Boston. It just seemed like such an epicenter for so many terrific things.
I mean, I think it was, and I think it still is in some respects. I'm a little older, and I don't engage as much as I used to, obviously. But when I was in the 90s, when I was there, for the most part, it was bustling, huge, you know, and all the people I talked to really appreciated the scene, I think, much like yourself. So when you came here, was that scene as crazy as you perceived it to be? Like, was it comparative to like where you came from?
Not in some ways there are some parallels, and it was so 100% like immersed in Louisville music, just as it sort of being a guarded community in some capacities, that being it not really relationable to any cities within range. I mean, we were sort of an island. It's almost equatable to a city like Minneapolis, where it just sort of felt sort of standalone in some strange ways. I mean, the deeper I sort of found myself plowing into it, the connections and the intersections between cities like Chicago and Washington D.C. those made sense to me, you know, because there was so much music coming from both of those cities that was attractive to a lot of this weird, isolated Midwestern Louisville community that was really, at that point, it didn't really seem like there was that much interest in sort of escaping. It was more about like, well, we're just here and let's just sort of make music and it was sort of like almost like a friendly competition between Louisville bands. But but then when I found my way out, when I found my way into Boston, I would have to say yes, absolutely. I mean, I was really surprised. Truth be told, I'm always really impressed and so appreciative when I show up anywhere. There are people, you know, there with even a small PA or a microphone or whatever. And showing up in Boston the first time was unusual because I think I met the biggest prick of a sound man that I think I've ever met in my life was at the Middle East, and he was being a total asshole to us.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, it was awful. It was awful and funny, but awful. Because, you know, we basically drove, we'd driven all night. We'd left at 6 in the evening and drove through the night and got into Boston around 3 or 4 in the afternoon the next day and just loaded into the Middle East. And the first thing he said was, "You're not playing here." You know, we walked in with all of our stuff and this jerk just said, "You're not even supposed to be here." And we just kind of, you know, just were like, "Oh, well, that's cool." And then instantly his whole perspective and demeanor with us shifted completely when Suzanne from Flower let him know that we were supposed to be there and that it was supposed to treat us a little bit nicer. But
unfortunately, I think there's some, I was going to ask you, like, you said you like went to all these, and you're always impressed by all these little cities, and you said it was like a little bit of like a competition. In Boston, it seemed like it was like a very deep-rooted competition, and everyone was fighting for space all the time. I think a common thing is that people say about Boston is like, it's too many bands, lots of music and too many bands.
Interesting. That's interesting.
Because everybody was in a band at some point or another. And there's still a few places to play. Was that sort of culture relevant or prevalent in other places, like that kind of like negative competition style like that?
None of that sort of creativity ever really seems negative to me. It always seems like a positive. You can never have too much of it. It's so hard for, I think, music, and even in that era when it was sort of booming, and you know, in the early mid 90s when my variety of music was sort of at its apex in some capacities, I don't think that there could have been too much. And it varies from city to city as far as I see it. But as my experience in Boston, you know, that whole section of time, that cross section of reality, just that can't really happen again. And that's not to say that it's going to get any better or any worse. It's just saying that, like, that version of my introduction to the Boston music scene and my Boston music community of the early mid 90s is just so special and unique. And I feel so fortunate to have been part of it in general, like geographically in general. But Boston, I mentioned Billy Ruane earlier, and he just, there was something about his energy and his capacity just to sort of bring things to life. I mean, for being such like an unassuming character, like in person, you know, you're just like, who's that weird guy in the back wearing a suit?
Yeah.
Like, who is that? But between that and meeting Talia and Chris and Arthur and Seth from Calm, and you know, and going on to play more shows with Codeine and those sorts of things, but also like our friends the Helms, Dan McCarthy, the McCarthy brothers, and they're just like, you know, like and Tina, they're just like such great, wonderful people. And when we would show up and just really wanting everybody just to have like a great, successful experience, you know, just wanting wanting that whole community just to sort of have a positive moment. So, I mean, there was definitely a lot of noise. I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of things going on, but it never really seemed unhealthy. It always just seemed like it was really trying to feed itself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a special time. And I think a lot of positive and really productive, amazing artistic stuff came out of it. And you said like, you don't think you'll see that sort of thing again. Is there something that you think that is responsible for that? Is there any one thing, or is it multiple things?
It's less about it being possible than it is it being possible for me. I mean, I'm just older, and I'm not of the state of mind or the consciousness or in a place where I would ever say that it can't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense that it just can't exist, because I think it probably does exist. I just am not. I mean, I'm almost, you know, I'm, you know, I've got I run a business, and I've got two kids, and I've got a whole other life. And I'm just as immersed in my playing of music. And, but as far as like, when I say it can't really happen again, it means like that version, those people of that time frame in my life are incomparable. They're immeasurably like unique, and they're just not replaceable. So I guess that's what I mean more than.
Mm-hmm.
I think the energy will certainly and probably still does exist, and there's beautiful music happening all over the planet constantly. You know, it's just I'm just not in a spot to where I am as immersed in it as like you said moments ago, like you're just not as immersed in it as you once were. And that's just the case for me as well, I think.
Well, I on this most recent, I guess, you're involved again, or you were maybe a year ago or whatever. And, you know, this shit came down the pike. How did you find getting back into it? You know, since Shipping News or whatever, was it as rewarding? Was it difficult? Was it, I don't know.
It was, I've been, you know, I never really stopped with, because I really wanted to. I mean, we in 2012, when my friend Jason passed away, it was sort of it wasn't even an awakening as far as like my involvement with music. It was just the likelihood of it sort of being something that I could do was shifting, because again, like I had carried Shipping News with me for, you know, since 1996, and that's almost, you know, it's a long time. It's 14 or 15 years worth of music.
It is.
And June of 44 had not played a show since the late 90s, since November 23rd or 21st or something like that. 1999 was the last show that we played before we'd stopped for the 18 years in between then and when we played again in May of 2018. And honestly, like we'd been asked, Juno 44 had been asked several times to play festivals or to get involved, but we just really couldn't figure out, speaking for myself, I guess I couldn't figure out, like, do I really want to, is this something that is worth, like, us really going through all the motions of sort of putting the whole thing back together? Because when we'd stopped, it wasn't really an amicable sort of stop. It was kind of messy and not mm-hmm. the best. And I've gone through some things in my brain about it where I was like, well, do I really want to do that? And it's something really significant had to present itself in order for me to even circulate the question to the other members of the group. Mm-hmm. And our friend Augustino from Uzeda, who's in Catania, asked us if we'd play their 30th birthday party back in May of 2018. And it was just sort of one of those, we have to do that sort of scenarios. Or at least I have to ask if everyone can do that and everyone could. And, you know, then it was a matter of just logistics of getting together, getting my like hands back in shape to play some of those songs because they're pretty acrobatic and all that. But really that part of it was pretty easy. Like at the end of the day, like it was fairly easy to accommodate the schedule and I guess, you know, relearn the songs as far as being able to perform them. And even getting back in the room with those guys after so long was really, really a beautiful thing for me. It was just an easy, it was fairly, you know, simple like components, just people just getting back together and playing music again and trying to figure out what it was that you loved about it. But the hardest part, I think, for me, jumping back into it after 7 years of having not done it was certainly not even 7 years after 18 years of not playing some of those songs. So mm-hmm. four songs was probably finding myself, finding the headspace, I guess, that I was in when we'd written those songs, just so that it was really important to me to not just present the music in an academic, just sort of performance sort of a way. It was really important for me to be able to try to dig my way back into certain scenarios that existed 20 years ago, you know, where I was living in Kentucky, you know, centering my headspace around the psychology of what some of those songs were about and trying to get kind of crawl back into that place while we're actually playing them, because so much of that music falls flat unless in terms of performance. I don't feel like I'm giving someone I don't feel like I'm really doing a good job with the show if I'm just going through the motions of playing the songs rather than actually seriously deep diving back into them and
sure.
presenting them in a way that, and not necessarily in the same way that we had done them in, you know, the mid late 90s, but more in a way of a contemporary version of that, but just sort of like a something that's relationable and makes sense. So that was actually the hardest part, was just figuring out a way to play those songs honestly and carefully enough that they seemed legitimate and not just like covers of those songs.
Yeah, I think that's difficult. I mean, I can't imagine going back and playing a song that I've written 20 years ago. I mean, I certainly have, but I'm not sure they have the same meaning. Like, what did you find yourself back in the place and you're like, this song doesn't have the same meaning anymore, or I can't play the song because it doesn't have the same meaning anymore? I think differently about it.
Yes. and definitely. Yes. I mean, we had talks of, you know, the group discuss those songs, you know, like I was having a really hard, I've had a really hard time with maybe two or three of them in particular. And the band just sort of convinced me that it was worth kind of opening up my 1997 journal and reading through 50 pages of whatever it was that became a song like Have a Safe Trip, Dear, which is the first song on our first record, you know, and I just was having a hard time sort of immersing myself in that, and I was ready to scrap it. And they said, that's going to, you know, that's like the first song, you know, that's the first song that we, that's those notes, those open harmonic notes of that first song are the first notes that anybody ever heard of our music. And it'll mean a lot to a lot of people if we play those songs and that song in particular. So, yeah, I mean, we quipped, and I, and some of them are harder for me to get through than others, but I don't think that we, there are a couple that I just was like, no, we're not going to do that. And no matter how much they tried to convince me that we should, I just said, no, I can't do that. I could, not only because I didn't really want to, but also because I physically couldn't play some
really?
Songs. Yeah, my hands just don't play guitar like that anymore. In fact, some of those older songs, there's a person on, I was watching some of our old shows on YouTube just to check my hand positions and to figure out how I played them. But I just didn't know how to do it. But
That's interesting that you even have that sort of backlog that you can actually go back and look at that stuff.
It's really curious because it didn't exist. I mean, that's another interesting curiosity about being a modern band versus a band from the late 90s, early 90s, is that that stuff just didn't exist, you know? None of that stuff existed. I mean, people, the reason like there's a 1997 Juno 44 show up on YouTube is because somebody recorded it on a camcorder or some giant VHS thing and then transferred it and got it up on.
Well, like all those Ruan tapes, finding, I think someone texted me and said like, oh, there's a Rodan show up on YouTube from his archive tapes, you know, and that must be insane. Cause I mean, how much of that stuff, again, did you forget if you ever were to play it again? And did you ever think that you'd see it on video?
No. I mean, a lot of it, no. I mean, some of it in real time, people were a lot less covert, or I should say just sort of like taking liberties just to record your shows, but bluntly, yeah. I mean, back then, people would ask you, they would approach you and say, look, I'm here with a couple of guys and we've got cameras and we're wondering if we can shoot you, you know, while you play. And you'd say, yes, of course, it'll be fun. You know, with respect to keeping safe distance, not the socially distanced version of it, but just not having a camera up in your face while you're trying to play a song. But now, you know, it's just interesting, like having, you know, like every note, every capture, every mistake is just so easily sort of documented. And so many people just like are reviewing these crappy iPhone recordings that people are putting right up right after the show with no, like just standing stage right. So all they're getting, like it's either a lot of me or a lot of Sean and cymbal wash. And they're like, this show sounds terrible. You know, it's like, wait, it's not even, what's wrong with you? You know, they're not even listening to a legitimate thing, but, yeah, it, you know, that part of it, like it was also curious for us just to sort of wrap our brains around, which is how immediate social media sort of makes all of these things and how accessible just sort of all of it is nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in reference to your earlier saying about delving back into songs of subjects that you may change your mind has changed on, you think you're going to be the new record that you guys put out, are you going to like, is it going to be more obviously influenced by this type of shit, that this, you know, stuff that you're living through now, obviously?
Sort of. I mean, the new record is sort of an odd experience for all of us. It was just something that we really were trying to get out of. It was something that was sort of unfinished business in some ways. Like we had all of these ideas for even back in that, like the late 90s, we were playing a lot of the songs that we'd recorded differently back then, and we'd even talked about back then about trying to record the more updated versions at some point, and then we broke up or stopped playing, and then when we got back together, those songs just continued to evolve and change. And there's that part of the newest record, but also not necessarily ubiquitously, but some of us weren't 100% happy with the way our personal relationship with the last record that June of 44 made.
I love that record.
Thank you.
I think it's great. And I was going to say, I'm like, not to derail you, and I'm just like, it obviously, and many people have said, like, it's certainly a shift for y'all. I don't want to derail you, but like, what was the impetus for that shift, I guess? And maybe that relates to what you're talking about with this new stuff as well.
There are a lot of things. I mean, our first two records were heavily influenced by songwriting from Sean and I. And that was not necessarily out of lack of creativity from Fred and Doug. It was more out of necessity, in a sense, because we were jumping into these schedules and these calendars where we had very limited time to actually be together to work on music. So it was more a matter of just like, here, just offering fairly rigid vantage points. Like, here's a full song and on guitar, structured in lyrics. Can you all play along with this? And can you all make this better? Can you add your notes and your flavors to these songs? And so, in a sense, like, the first two and a half records, first two and a half 244 records were not full, I don't think that we fully had reached a point to where we were all integrating into the music as much as I think everybody wanted to. So by the time, we got through Engine Takes the Water and then Tropics and Iridians, and then we were traveling quite a bit, and the EP came out, and it was just all this time being spent together, and we just started talking a lot more about like integrating all of our ideas and influences. So I think we made a concerted effort to spend more time like just writing our third proper full length, which was 4 Great Points, where we just sort of all four of us were just trying to punch in and get our ideas across and write all the songs together. So at that point, like, I think is where we started to sort of like migrate in this direction where we were more of a full band. But then on the very last record, I was just really like, I don't really know what the deal was with that, honestly. Like, it's still sort of confusing to me. I mean, we jumped into writing the second to last June 44 record, and we didn't really have like a whole lot of ideas. It was more a matter of like, Doug had constructed a couple, two or three ideas that were really beautiful, like tape loops and things that he'd got from some of our live shows, and we built songs off of those, which was really, really fun and interesting, but hard to sort of connect with in terms of like where we'd been before. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit difficult for me as a songwriter, just to not have as deep of a personal connection with some of those particular songs. And then a lot of that music for that last record, the Anahata record, we wrote sort of while we were recording it. I mean, we just sort of were putting it together as we went. And that was a really, really unusual way for me to sort of work. Because I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not going to say anything about Sean, but as far as myself as a guitar player, I'm kind of like, I hack my way through songs. Like, I'm not like that. I'm just not good.
I think some people would probably disagree with you, but that's fine.
Well, that's sweet. But I mean, I practice all the time. I play all the time, but I just don't feel like I have some of the I mean, I don't feel like Doug and Fred are virtuosic and prolific and incredibly gifted musicians. I mean, they're just fast and they're intuitive. And honestly, it was just hard at that point for me just to keep up with how quickly things were happening. Because like I said, like I write a lot of music, but I'm not really that awesome as an improv player or just coming up with ideas like on the spot. And I think I was having that last record was a bit of a struggle for me. So,
I mean, when did you pick up a guitar?
I want to say when I was maybe 13 or 14 years old.
I mean, I think I'm the same way in a lot of ways. I'm kind of a hack myself, and I never I took some lessons, you know, but like as far as improvisation goes, like I didn't really get even realized in it until much later, now in my 40s. You know, so I'm gonna say like, you know, I played a lot of similar music, I guess, you know, post rock, whatever you want to call it. Sure. Do you think that's a lot of that stuff kind of limits improvisation in a lot of ways? And maybe, I don't know, just makes certain people gravitate towards it. It's, you know, mm-hmm. writing specific parts for things and writing music specifically for what you, and then the improvisation part kind of becomes difficult in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, that definitely makes a lot of sense and resonates. I think we'd gone through, and maybe that's it. Like we'd gone through 3 or 4 different recording sessions where there was a lot of pre-planning. There's a lot of like rehearsing and there's a lot of structure already in place. And Doug and Fred are just, they're hugely at that point and probably into this day are hugely, and I am too. I mean, there's influence of like jazz and Coltrane and Miles Davis and, you know, avant-garde jazz and all these different mm-hmm. things, but that they were hugely capable of sort of and prolific in sort of like pulling that kind of stuff off. And I think they wanted to flex that muscle. And I wanted to, Sean and I both wanted to support that, you know, of course, but at the end of the day, it was just a lot harder, I think, for us to sort of meet them with that version of sort of creativity than it was for them to meet us with what we were able to bring.
If that makes sense. When you guys started, was Doug wasn't in coding still. Was Fred in Hoover anymore? I'm not even sure.
When we started, Doug was still in coding, and he was also playing in a band called Rex.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And Hoover had recently broken up, and he was in a band called the Crown Hate Ruin with Joe, who was also from Hoover. He and Joe started playing in a new band called Crown Hate Ruin. And Sean was traveling quite a bit with Lungfish at the time. And at the end of, you know, throughout the last couple of years of Rodin's music, I'd met all of them, either playing shows with them or them coming to shows or me being at their shows or whatever. But we'd all talked about trying to get together to start something when there was time. And when Rodin broke up, which was, I think we stopped in September of 94 was our last, or I think it was September 24th of 1994 was the last Rodin show. Within 3 or 4 days, I called Sean and Fred and asked them if they wanted to play. We didn't really know who we were going to be able to ask to play drums, but I just thought Doug, after coding had practiced in the basement of the house I was living in Louisville, and I think it was 92 or 93. And I just remember talking to Doug and just loving him so much. And mm-hmm. I thought if he could make it work, he was a straight up working musician. I mean, he was in 2 busy touring bands, and I just didn't want to, I didn't want to overburden him or tax him. So the concept for the first time that we got together was essentially, Sean and I will show up. We'll have like a record's worth of material. Let's write for, get it all together over the span of a week or two and then record it. And then that'll be it. We'll just be done.
Mm-hmm.
But we ended up with a record out of it that Touch and Go put out, or Quarter Stick put out. And that it just sort of manifested from there where I was basically behaving as more of like the organizer, the liaison between everyone, trying to make it work because I had the time. You know, I wasn't really in a full-time music project. I was just trying to scrap something together and, just when they're making artwork and printing the artwork at my job in Chicago. And then when the release happened, you know, trying to put together a tour to support the album. And it just sort of continued to grow. And I think it was something that we all were sort of surprised by back then, like how, you know, how it just sort of not necessarily snowballed, but it was just like a slow build up where, you know, our shows started pretty good and they just continuously got better and better and better, and that was great. And then I think we were all also really surprised when after we did this thing in 2018, when we started up again, how just unusual it was to have people still be interested and still showing up and still kind of caring about us. It was pretty terrific.
It is. I mean, I was amazed that I pretty much was relegated to the fact that there was going to be no more records. So it was amazing to see that. I remember reading long ago that first record was sort of like you were just saying, kind of pieced together, or you had the material and these guys just needed to find the time to do it. Like you were saying, feels very much like maybe what's happening now. And a lot of people doing things over, you know, sending tapes and or sending shit across the internet and trying to make music happen with people without actually seeing them all the time. It's interesting that it happened back then.
I wish I was more savvy with Logic or Pro Tools or just recording digitally, but I don't know. Like the way that I've been sort of introducing those guys to my parts these days is just using my phone, you know, recording demos on my phone and just texting them to them, you know, like, cause I don't want to send them complete versions of the songs, and I don't want them to finish the songs. I don't want them to be working. Like, I just want them to kind of get the ideas into their heads, and then when we get together, we can compose the music together. And I think out of necessity, certainly for this past year, it's been really interesting to see how people have sort of gone into survival mode and figured out ways to, you know, just be creative and to make music, you know. And like Chris, you know, not to bring up Chris Brokaw again, but he is incredibly present and prolific on, you know, performing online. I mean, he does like a concert like every 2 weeks, you know, and it's just really, really, for me, it's really useful and really hopeful to see somebody who's just kind of chugging along and still trying to make it work, you know. And Talia keeps putting out records, and actually in 2020, like somehow I carved out and was able to cobble out three releases, which doesn't make any, or four releases, you know. We had our new new old music record that came out, and Touch and Go put out two vinyl reissues that were out for Record Store Day. And then I put out this weird self-released 7-inch that came along with like this booklet thing that I made, but it was lathe cut. It wasn't like a big release. I wouldn't even call it official, but it was just a matter of like at the onset of, you know, stay at home orders back in March this past year, there was so much emphasis, you know, being put on how to like just like what rules to follow and what you were supposed to do and like how you were just supposed to stay home and all these sorts of things. It's like, how am I going to get my way through this? You know, and initially it was a matter of just trying to make sure my kids were happy. You know, like all I really wanted to do was just make sure that they didn't take the brunt of, or I didn't want my stress over the, you know, the state of things to sort of migrate to them and have their whole situation while we're in at home be completely awful. So it was just about keeping them happy and keeping them laughing. But late at night, I would just sit and write, you know, I would just pull out, get my laptop out or a notepad or something. I would just start writing and like words, like stories, like kind of things that I would be telling to people if we were sitting around a campfire. And that went on for, you know, just on my own. Like, it was just like, well, I'm just going to write these things. Like, because people were in my house sitting around talking to me, and I would get, ended up publishing a small booklet, and accompanying that was the 7-inch that I just put out on my own. But, you're right. It is interesting just to see how history sort of does repeat itself, you know, as far as like what we
in
were.
In a way. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you have this business, and I'd imagine that it artistically, I'm sure it relieves a lot of this tension as well. Like, when did you start doing printing?
I guess around 95. Carrie, my wife, and I, she was living in Minneapolis and I was living in Louisville. And we wanted to kind of live together, but not in Minneapolis or not in Louisville. And right in between those two cities is Chicago. And we moved there in October of 1995. And it was convenient for music stuff because there was a lot of bands, a lot of friends, and our label was situated in Chicago. But also we'd gone to art school in Kansas City, and two guys that graduated the year before us started and ran a letterpress company that migrated from Kansas City upon their graduation to Chicago. And I wanted to learn the process. You know, I was looking for a job when I got to Chicago. And so that was the perfect job for me, because I wanted to learn the process with friends of mine at this beautiful thing. But also at that time, I was looking for interesting, sort of not gross and plasticky ways to package my records. And it just sort of like it was a perfect marriage for like learning that industry while also sort of satisfying another need. And just curious, because the first two jobs that I printed at Fireproof Press was the name of the business. The first job that I printed was a round the clock job where there were three or four of us all running the presses nonstop for almost 3 weeks. And that was the first pressing of Shellac at Action Park.
Awesome.
And it was just insane. It was just like stacks and stacks and stacks of records everywhere. And it was just really crazy just to be part of that, and really energized and kind of like inspiring, really, just to see that much stuff happening. But then the second job, which was far less in terms of scale, but in terms of psychology, it was just as intense, was the first Juno 44 record. It was the second job that I printed at Fireproof. And, you know, just seeing, you know, you kind of like, not to give too much information, but the first pressings of those, the first pressing with the with CDs and LPs, it was just seeing that much of your own stuff kind of just sitting around and on these skids, like all of these stacks of paper of uncut LP jackets and CD jackets just surrounding you, is kind of daunting and incredibly claustrophobic. But it was really nice to be able to, do that work and to learn how to run those machines and to do that letterpress work for the first time, working on two such beautiful projects, or one beautiful project and one project that was personally one of my own.
Yeah. So how did it end up in Connecticut? Do you have a love for New England?
I just, you know, it was a great business model, you know, moving to the state where I'd never received a single commission or sold a single piece of artwork. It was a really, really good plan. That's a joke. It was a terrible, but no, truth be told, like my wife, Carrie, she's from here. She's from, she's from New Haven.
I have family in New Haven, or I did have family in New Haven.
I'm sorry?
I had family in New Haven at one point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, so we were at the end of around 2009, we talked about trying to kind of move closer to her parents, because she's really, really close with them. And at that point, they were starting to kind of, you know, show their wear just a little bit. And she felt like, not that her job in Chicago was sedentary, but more that she'd reached a place with her profession where she, it wasn't going to develop or kind of grow anymore where she was. So she started on a job hunt and found a more expansive but similar version of her job at Yale. Up here, and you know, initially when we, you know, when I was saying that she wanted to get closer to her folks, we were thinking, you know, within 100-mile radius maybe of her parents, 150 miles, like not like literally, like where we ended up living when we first moved here was 6 addresses away from their house. It was like right around the corner, and it was they still live in her parents still live in the house that she grew up in. So it was just a really, really unusual transition for us to move after having had essentially 15 to 16 years of complete autonomy and independence to suddenly be like 600 yards away from the house that she grew up in, where her parents still live. But for me, and for like my, as far as the transition for me, like, getting out of Chicago and moving here was a bit scary, because, you know, a significant portion of my work volume for the print shop was Chicago based, and I just didn't know if that was going to come with me or not, and a lot of it did. But you know, there were a few things, like Carrie, when we got here, she compelled me and had, you know, said that it would be a good idea for me maybe to start using the shop a little bit differently than I hadn't, you know, in this 11 years that we've been in business before we moved to New Haven, I hadn't really made any artwork of my own in the studio. It was all commission based or production work. So, you know, right after we got here, I just started, you know, banging out my own things, and that was really, really satisfying. And then,
yeah, I mean, does it fill the same void for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Certainly for the transition, for the first 2 or 3 years while we were trying to get my legs in the Northeast, like, it was definitely, you know, a little bit sketchy as far as like, you know, just consistency and trying to fill the gaps. But, you know, it all just sort of found its way. And by the time my regular, like, I was back to the capacity that I was at before leaving Chicago, it was just interesting because I developed this whole other flow of income into the studio, making, you know, weirdo, strange, cheap art prints, you know. It's like, oh, you know, so that was really great. And really interesting. It's also, you know, like, you know, in a more, you know, it's not exactly the same, but, you know, after June of 44 went on a trip in January, we traveled to the Midwestern United States in January of last year. And, you know, we played a show in Chicago. I think it was on January 25th last year. And it was the last show that, you know, of course, that we played. But when I got back from those dates is when COVID was really starting to sort of hit in North America. And then, also when I got back from that trip, my print shop had work all the way out through almost August. It was like 7 months of just nonstop.
That's crazy. Work,
which is an unusual thing for me. And I was really stoked. I was totally happy, but COVID hit and almost 80% of it just completely disappeared.
Oh shit, really?
Yeah, well, a lot of it dematerialized for, you know, starting around, you know, in mid-end of April, it all went away. But fortunately, by the end of May, beginning of June, it all came back again. So.
Yeah, I mean, I work in a similar business, and I do reclaim wood, and a lot of it is, you know, basically based on, you know, feeling, I guess. And the unfortunate thing for me was that everybody was inside and just looking at their stuff that they had looked at for their whole, like, however long they've lived in their house, they just started replacing everything with reclaimed wood. So it worked out well for me and my business. Which I really
work? What is it that you do?
We reclaim wood out of buildings. We take down when buildings are coming down or barns are coming down, we'll reclaim the wood and sell it.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun. I've been doing it for a while. It's great.
Oh, that's awesome.
I was surprised, honestly, like when this stuff came down, I was like, crap, I'm gonna lose my job. I don't know. It's like, who's gonna buy this stuff when they, you know, when no one's working and everything, you know, everyone is strapped and
sure.
You know, I was surprised at what happened afterwards. It was really interesting.
Good for you, man. That's really encouraging that it didn't totally fall out completely, you know, that you're able to keep up. And I mean, honestly, like when Dexterity Press, when my print shop was picking, you know, was slow or at the onset of the business, and when music wasn't really that consistent. Music's never really been a consistent stream of income for me in general, and never really, I tried not to rely on it for that, but I guess it was around 2000 when Carrie and I returned from Philadelphia, when we moved back to Chicago from Philly from her graduate school. I got in the trades. It wasn't anything as sort of like as heavy lifting as like reclaiming wood from old buildings or anything like that. But we would do light carpentry, and I would do like kind of mural painting and faux finish work in the North Shore of Chicago. And I've always tried to keep my foot in that pool, because that work is like any of those trade jobs, for me, they're really, really gratifying and fun. I really like that work and I like having that skill, but also they're just never really going anywhere. You know, you always, that work is always going to be there for you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I wish that I had done this from the get-go sometimes, like done something in a trade rather than doing something else that I've done, you know?
Sure.
Work retail or whatever I've done my whole life. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. I mean, well, what do you think? I mean, I thought it was a good conversation. Is there anything that I think we missed? I didn't want to go too hard on anything, like, you know, from the bands. I wanted to talk to you about, I guess, life now. I mean, how do you feel in this time? You're pretty political, and I would love to talk about that. I don't want to go too deep because it can get very deep, and I'm sure we can have a great conversation about it and be angry about it. At least I'm angry about it.
I try like to, you know, I like at this point, like I find myself being like, I feel like the two parties are either, you know, you're either enraged or you're filled with shame. I don't feel like I just don't feel
I think,
like
I think it goes both ways now. I mean, yeah, either party.
Like the two-party system, it's either you're really pissed off or you're just really like disappointed. You know, those are the two parties, disappointment or pissed off. But I of course, you know, I voted for Biden, you know, and yep. and I'm I stand behind that vote. I feel like it was the best decision, and I wasn't not going to vote. And I feel like as far as like paying attention and just sort of watching, you know, my other friends, some of my friends, I'm more lefty, more left than I think most people think, you know, could be, you know, I'm not even remotely in centrist, but as far as reality is concerned and just sort of like what is possible, to me, it just seems logical that you will always support the side that you think is better. Yeah. And I think that like, I err on the side of thinking that someone who speaks in complete sentences and isn't, you know, at least seems to be trying to make things better for children in cages and the environment and getting back into the Paris Accord and all those things. I think those are really good decisions. And I feel like my progressive friends, and I really love them and they keep me in check, but I just feel like they're just never like, they're like, there's just always pissed off about like something that, you know, like they're just, they subscribe to this sort of train of thought that Biden is the same as Trump.
Well, that's ridiculous. I don't think Biden's as progressive as we need, but he is what we need right now. In a sense.
I think so. I mean, my first choice and my second choice and my third choice were off, you know, they just didn't even make it. They didn't make the cut. My first choice was Bernie and I was for Sanders. I was for Elizabeth Warren, you know, and I liked all these people and it's like, you know, like, but there's always something about all of them that pisses somebody off. And I was just like, I have a hard time right now. Like, honestly, like, it's just such a relief just to not this news cycle be filled with like dumb tweets and antagonism, you know, like, and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, speaking in complete sentences, it's very comforting to hear someone speak calmly and with some empathy, as opposed
definitely and just not like feeling like they have to be on, like you don't want to hear from your president every day. I don't want to hear from him every day. I didn't I like Obama, but I didn't want to hear from him every day, and every day like I would just hear some insanity coming out of Trump, and it just was it was just totally 100% exhausting. And I think in the long game, like, and to me, the long game is like, it's not as immediate as either side really thinks things should sort of happen or how quickly the pace of things should be. I think Republicans think it should all just be at once, and that leads to an insurrection. And the Democrats are just wanting, the minimum wage increase, since that didn't happen with this new, incentive plan, the stimulus plan, like they're just mad and think that it's a total failure. And Biden hasn't even been in the office for 45 or 50 days. What is it, like 2 months now or something like that? So I just think that just with it, like everything is still within range and it's still possible. I just think we just need to take a little bit of a breath and, you know.
Yeah, I unfortunately, I think media in general breeds that sort of mentality. This stuff needs to like come down the pike in a day or so. It's just unfortunately not the way government works. Unfortunately, you can't have that. You can't have it overnight.
Well, the truth of the matter is like you'll hear, you know, all of these grand, huge, and huge promises during the campaigns and in the opening weeks of any presidential term, and then eventually it just becomes nothing happening, you know. It's just like so it's just like, you know, like you just like one steady stream of compromise. I guess the most frustrating thing for me, like out of the past 4 years, was just trying, you know, hearing about how we needed to sort of you know, be diplomatic and sort of be bipartisan and all these sorts of things. And it's just like, it's just sort of like somebody come up saying like, yeah, we'll, you know, we should definitely get along and we can totally get along and we'll, you know, we'll do whatever you want as long as you just shut the fuck up about everything that we just did. You know, we accept, you know, we apologize as long as you just shut up about everything we just did. And it's like, no, we just lived through 4 years of just really
awful,
horrible, shit. Horrible governance and just awful, awful things. And it's not so, you know, I just don't, I can't imagine like all of this kumbaya kind of garbage right now. And there's still so much stuff that's completely unresolved from the behaviors of some of those people. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz. Those guys are just horrible, horrible people. They're just awful people, you know. It's just like,
and no one's gonna hold them accountable. I mean, because they're all in the same boat. You know, they're all still fucking for Trump, even though, you know, he has no power over them, more or less, I think, in my mind. He can't tweet anymore, so what's the deal? What's the difference?
Yeah, well, there's some, the quiet is, it's unnerving, you know, it's like, what is he actually doing right now? In some ways, you could say CNN and Trump had a codependency problem.
Oh, for sure.
But, and I don't want to hear from the guy, but the fact of the matter is, as far as like not knowing what he's doing right now is scary, because you know he does have such a weird, crude, and significant like rule over such a strong and major, like a fairly significant contingency of this country. You know, it's like that guy's just such a, it's just nuts. And I don't know, man. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting.
I guess. What's the future? Anything? You said you were sending some stuff to these other guys. Is there something in the works, you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, we had before the pandemic hit, we had a lot of plans for this past year where we were going to, you know, get this new old record out. But then we'd wanted, you know, if we'd been able to play music with each other and be in the same room with one another, we had plans to write and record another actual new record of all new songs and all of that. For me, like my grocery list of new music is fairly immense. I just need to be able to work it out with those guys. So, you know, whenever we can rehearse again, it just means we're just going to pick up where we left off, I think, and try to write a new record.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, side note, sorry about that fire. Fuck.
Oh man, that was terrible.
I was sad to see those instruments. I feel like they're classic instruments.
Yeah, that was fucking, that was one
Fred's,
of the
Fred's bass. Right, was it your guitar?
It was not. No, that was Sean's guitar. And it was Fred's bass, yeah.
I've had a few fires in my lifetime.
I mean, I've had, you know, minor fires, but floods are my sort of choice of to destroy things that I care about. But no, the fire was, they were picking me up at the airport in Chattanooga. And while we were on the way back from the airport, Sean's wife called to say that his studio burned to the ground. So, you know, and he's still, you know, and that was at the front end of getting ready to go finish a recording and to play a series of shows, you know, the Midwest dates that I was just talking about, you know, right before COVID hit. And when you're in the middle of when you've got three people that have flown from, you know, all different corners of the United States there with you to visit, to write and to go play shows and stuff, Sean went into some deep like protective I've got to just immerse myself with these guys right now, and whatever happened at my studio, I'm just going to have to deal with later. But when, you know, he got through the trip fine, but when he got home and just processing all of that loss, you know, the studio was something that he'd worked on for almost 11 or 12 years in Chattanooga, just building it out. It was an old, the studio was an old horse stable that was on he and his wife Diana's property.
Jesus.
And he'd, you know, he'd made it somewhat, you know, all season. It was chilly, but he had a wood burning stove in it. And he would go out in the morning and cook up some logs, and it would warm up the studio space while he was inside getting his coffee or taking a shower or whatever. And then he would come back out and rehearse or write for the course of the day. So he did, it was just one of those freak things where the wood stove failed. And instead of the heat from the wood stove exhausting to the chimney, it exhausted into the building. And it just caught the whole thing on fire and burnt it down. So it really, really was one of the most, it was really, really, really awful.
That is awful. I mean, losing instruments that you've been with for that long is tough. And I mean, any sort of fire is gut wrenching.
Yeah, it sucks. It just sucks.
Speaking from experience,
you know, I think he just figured out a way to accept that he, you know, lost all that stuff and is trying to kind of get through it still, you know, to this day. I think he's still trying to clean up the mess. And
I still have CDs. I'm not sure if you still do. But I take them out of the box sometimes and they still smell like soot.
Oh God. And you're like, no, you're like, no.
And this was 2005, long time.
What was it? Was it your house or was it a studio fire or what was it?
Yeah, it was my house. I lived in Watertown with a bunch of guys from you know, the Boston scene, like Cape Cod kids. And Dave Norton, do you know Dave Norton?
I think so.
He was in Victory at Sea for a while.
Yeah.
So I lived with him and some other guys, and it was just a freak accident. Of old wiring, electric fire, place burned down.
That's terrible.
Not fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like my situation was, we lived in a Philly, what was called a Trinity house, which is just like a 3-floor row house essentially, and I had a small rehearsal space in the basement, and I left my SG down there while I was on trip. On a tour with Shipping News with my other guitar. And when I got home, Carrie, my wife, said the basement had flooded, but she moved everything, got it up off the floor, and everything seemed dry. But apparently my guitar was underwater for a number of however long, and didn't even think to open the case to make sure that it was okay.
Ugh.
And the whole thing was just filled with water, and the guitar just that came delaminated and just completely fell apart inside the case and just covered with mold.
Ugh.
That was so sad.
That is very, very sad.
That was so sad. Like, oh no, it's like stealing someone's ladder. It's like the weather came stole your ladder, or like, you know, I don't know.
So it's something that you do work with every day. You're like, oh shit.
I know exactly. It's like, you don't take my lawnmower. That's my lawnmower. You know? It's awful.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you. It was.
You too, sir. And let me know if you need anything else or if you have any more questions. And seriously, man, thanks for taking the time, and I really appreciate it.
I thank you for taking the time, and I think I'll get back in touch with you if you want to send me a picture of yourself that you want to use, and then. A song for an outro, whatever song you want.
Okay, terrific. I'll do both of those things. I'll try to do it tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
just a